lecture is the last lecture in the series on Reggae Calculus. So all the questions should be answered in these lectures.
We'll see. Thank you. I've written up some references here. You'll find a lot of the references in this review paper. So anything older than 1992, you should find there. There are some more recent references in this paper, but this is a bit more general than Reggae Calculus, so it's only about the first, 40 or 50 references that are Reggae Calculus. I've written a review recently, which is supposed to appear in a book edited by Daniele Arriti, published by CUP, which had come out in the autumn. And then the area of Reggae Calculus, which is one of the things I'm going to talk about today, that's not included in either of these reviews, so I've just put a reference down there. So before I get on to area Reggae Calculus, which was supposed to be the subject of this last lecture, I do want to cover a few of the other things which I intended to do but haven't covered so far. First of all, let me say something briefly about boundary terms in Reggae Calculus. So far, we've been ignoring any boundaries there might be, assuming that our manifolds don't have boundaries. But obviously, that's not always the case. And Hartle and Sorkin derived the Reggae Calculus equivalent of the Gibbons-Hawking boundary term. And I'll just tell you roughly how they did it. In deriving the Reggae field equations, you'll remember we use a particular identity that's satisfied in each simplex, which was that the sum over the hinges in a simplex of the volumes of the hinges times the variation of the dihedral angles. So hinges I and simplex Q d theta Qi by some edge length. So the sum of the, in four dimensions, it would be sum of the areas times the variation of the dihedral angles within a four simplex of zero. Now, if you have a manifold with boundary, it may be that you don't have all the terms that you need to satisfy this identity in simplices near the boundary. So the way that Hartle and Sorkin found the extra term was to insist that they inserted exactly what you needed so that you got the usual Reggie equations for all the interior edges, and then the assumption was that the edges on the boundary were actually kept fixed. I probably should have written there may be a problem with this near the boundary. So the Reggie equations hold for all interior edges, while boundary edges are fixed. That's equivalent to specifying the metric on the boundary. So So this extra term, sorry, this pen seems to be fading rather fast. You take the sum over the hinges on the boundary. And you still have the volume of each hinge. And then instead of the deficit angle, you have another angle. This is very similar to a deficit angle, but it's defined to be, it's rather than 2 pi minus the sum of the angles, it's actually pi minus the sum of the dihedral angles at the hinge. And Hartle was able to show that this is equivalent to the Gibbons-Hawking term in the continuum. Which just involves the integral of the trace of the intrinsic curvature times the square root of the determinant of the 3 metric on the boundary. So we're talking about 4 dimensions here. Now, in quantum applications, it's not always the metric that's specified on the boundary. It may be the connection or some combination of the connection and the metric, and we don't actually know what the appropriate boundary term is in those cases. At least I don't, and I don't know of anybody else who does. I was hoping to say something about simplicity or mini superspace and quantum cosmology, but I think I won't even write anything down there. That's the study of calculating the wave function of the universe by integrating over all 4 metrics, 4 geometries, which have the 3 geometry you're interested in as a boundary. This was all set up by Hartle and Hawking. And Hartle showed, he argued, first of all, that one can get some sort of approximation to this by just integrating over what he called mini superspace, so just reducing the number of variables. And one way of implementing that is to integrate over Regi complexes, and there has been some work done in that. Matter and the measure I was also going to talk about, but in 4 dimensions, originally in early work on Regi calculus, the sort of matter that was included was just uniform dust distributed throughout simplices, and then some people included fluids using velocity potentials. But there hasn't been a great deal of work on matter. I mean, people have included scalar fields defined at vertices, and then some people have defined spinners within simplices, usually at the vertices of the dual lattice. As far as the measure goes, the integration measure in the functional integral, there is disagreement about that. The disagreement is basically whether you need what the so-called Fadyev-Popov determinant included or not. And the argument is really whether you have to divide through by the volume of the gauge group when you're doing the integral. Hartle had a nice argument to say, I mean, the argument superficially looks as though it doesn't really matter, even if the volume of the gauge group is infinite. I'll just write that down. His argument was that what you'll usually want to calculate in quantum gravity is the expectation value of some operator. And formally, that would be defined by expectation value of A is the integral over some measure. It's a function of the metric. The operator times, this is Euclidean, so we have exponential of minus the action. It's a function of G. And then you have to divide through by the integral of exponential of the at minus the action. And his argument was that even if the gauge group produces an infinite volume, two diffeomorphic metrics are going to contribute the same way to the top and the numerator and the denominator, because A and I are both invariant functions. They're both invariant under diffeomorphisms. So each of these integrals, the integral on the top and the bottom, will contain the infinite volume of the gauge group. And formally, it will cancel between the top and the bottom. I've seen that argument used to justify not bothering with Fadeev-Popov determinants and so often. I've used it myself sometimes. But Hartle, to be fair to him, Hartle does actually say that even though that happens formally, to implement it, then you probably do need to have all the machinery of ghosts and gauge-fixing terms and all that sort of thing. People have asked whether I was going to talk about numerical simulations of discrete quantum gravity, and I'll just say something very briefly because I really want to get on to the area regicalculus. The idea here is to start with some background, usually a flat background, it doesn't have to be, and then make small variations numerically. So you actually set up a situation where you change all the edge lengths either sequentially or in batches or all of them together. And then you use a Monte Carlo algorithm. So what you do is to you make small changes in the edge lengths. And if those changes increase the action, then you forget about them. So you reject them. And if the action decreases, then you accept the new edge lengths with a certain probability. And the system evolves towards some sort of equilibrium configuration about which it makes quantum fluctuations. And at that stage, you can calculate expectation values of various operators. Oh, I have no time to review the results here, and I was going to say something about how we constructed the curvature squared action, but I think I'll have to leave that out too. I'll just mention one result. If you have a lattice with topology of a torus, so you take periodic boundary conditions, this is in four dimensions, then it seems that the system develops an average negative curvature at strong coupling. So those are sort of results you can come up with, but I really want to get onto area regicalculus now. First of all, let me say what I mean and give some motivation for it. I said that the variables in regicalculus were taken to be the edge lengths, and that's true in all dimensions, not just in three dimensions, where the hinges are also the edges. And in spin foam models in three dimensions, models like the Ponzano-Reggie model, the representations of the group are actually assigned to the edges. So spin foam in 3D representations of the group that you're interested in are assigned to the edges. And when people tried generalizing these models to four dimensions, to, for instance, the Barrett-Crane model, it seemed as though the thing you had to do was to assign representations to the triangles. And this led Carlo, I think he was the first person to suggest it, to wonder whether maybe spin foam models in four dimensions were related to a sort of hybrid variety of regicalculus, where the basic variables were the triangle areas rather than the edge lengths. Now, this fitted in with some idea that Jarmo Mäkelä had done, where he was producing a sort of modification of regicalculus involving the Ashtakar variables, and he used triangle areas there. But he noted the fact that usually you have more triangles than edge lengths, so you actually get a constraint between the triangle areas because they depend on a smaller number of edge lengths. And once you implement those, try and include those constraints, then you basically get back to the original regicalculus where the variables are the edge lengths. But the other possibility is to take the triangle areas as fundamental variables and see what that does for us, where we get with that idea. So try taking these as independent variables, not worrying about constraints between them. So I'll write down a bit of formalism and show that some problems come up rather early, but it still leads to some very interesting ideas. Well, the basic reason that this makes sense is that a four-simplex actually has the same number of edges and triangles, has 10 edges, 10 triangles. So from the point of view of counting variables, it seems a sensible thing to interchange these as fundamental variables. I mean, this is all because if you want to choose two things from five possibilities, you get the same number as if you choose three things from five possibilities. So the numbers of edges and triangles are the same. And we'd expect to be able to invert the relationship between the areas and the edges. We all know how to express triangle areas in terms of edges. And if we could do that, then we'd be able to express the regiaction, basically the proportional to the sum of sum over triangles. We're in four dimensions. I'll write that as AT as a function of edge length times deficit angle at triangle T, which is also a function of the edge lengths or their squares. So we'd be able to express that, hope to be able to express that in terms of the areas. Now, there are a number of problems already. First of all, it's not so easy to invert the relations. There are several different formulae for the area of a triangle in terms of edge lengths. One way we could write it is triangle with vertices I, J, and K. The area squared is you have the products of the lengths in pairs. And then you have to subtract the squares of the lengths. And you can see it's not going to be particularly easy to solve for a whole set of relations like that in terms of, to get the edge lengths in terms of the areas. But there's something a bit more problematic, which is that the Jacobian of the transformation turns out it's actually singular if you have, I'm going to be vague here, it's singular if you have a certain number of right angles in your simplicity, in your simplex. So this is all within one simplex we're thinking. So it's singular for various configurations with right angles. So we'll have to avoid such configurations if we're going to make sense of this. We have to restrict our variation, our edge lengths, to be somewhere near the equilateral configuration or something like that. And then secondly, this nice matching that we get for a single simplex between the numbers of edges and the number of triangles doesn't work if you have more than one simplex. So the matching between numbers of variables does not work in general. And I'll give a simple example of that. Let's suppose that we've got four simplices meeting on a common tetrahedron. So here's our tetrahedron, which is in both of the four simplices. And then let's suppose one of the four simplices, it has to have another vertex, which will be joined to all the vertices of this common tetrahedron. And then we have another four simplex over here with edges joined to all the vertices of the tetrahedron. So that's a simple enough configuration. Two four simplices, the red things meeting on this blue tetrahedron. That's the face between them. And this complex has actually got 14 edges and 16 triangles. So straight away, we don't have the same number of edge and area variables there. And in fact, for any closed form manifold, you can show from the Dane-Somerville relations that the number of triangles is greater than or equal to 4/3 of the number of edges. So this will be a problem in general. Now, this can give rise to a rather strange situation because we could consider each of these simplices separately. And we'll assume we're in a region where there's not a problem with singularity of the Jacobian. So we'll assume that all the triangle areas are specified. And then in each four simplex, assuming the Jacobian non-singular, solve for the edge lengths. And you can get a very weird situation where the edge of one of the edges of the tetrahedron has a different length depending on whether you solve for it in this four simplex or in this four simplex. And you might think that's a bit hard to believe, but I have actually constructed examples where you can see that. I don't have them written down here, but you can certainly have that possibility. So you can obtain different edge lengths for edges in common tetrahedron. Depending on in which four simplex they were calculated. So the question is whether this makes any sense at all, and I'll say a bit more about that later. But let's now continue with the idea that somehow this formalism makes sense, even though we've obviously got an interpretation problem here. And let's see what field equations we get. Well, we have the usual field equations, but let's see what solutions we get. now we've written our action, I'll call it IAR, the area Reggie thing. We've written it all in terms of triangle areas. So it's the sum over triangles T, AT, and then we've expressed the deficit angle in terms of these triangle areas by first calculating it in terms of the edge lengths and then using the formulae for the edge lengths in terms of the triangle areas. And since our triangle areas are fundamental variables, we now vary with respect to one of the triangle areas, say AU. And that gives, first of all, varying this part, we just get epsilon u. And then the other term is a sum over t, at, d epsilon t by dau. And then we have to think whether Reggie's identity about the variation of deficit angles will apply in this case. Well, it turns out that it does actually apply. What we'll do, first of all, is write the deficit angle as 2 pi minus the sum of the dihedral angles. So here we'll get minus sigma at and then d by dau of the sum of the dihedral angles. And what I'm going to do is use the chain rule to express the derivative with respect to the area in terms of a derivative with respect to an edge length. That's going to be within a single four simplex. Perhaps I should do one step at a time. So that's the sum over simplices Q. What I'll do first is exchange the order of summation. So this is a sum over simplices Q, and then this is a sum over triangles T in simplex Q. And then I'm going to use the chain rule within a single four simplex. We've said that since we'll assume we're staying away from regions where the Jacobian is singular, so we can use the chain rule there. And we'll get d theta qi by dsi dsi by dau. So that's using the chain rule. And then this part is actually going to be zero for each simplex, according to what Reggie proved. So in fact, this term goes away, as it did in the conventional case, and our solution of our field equations is just that all the deficit angles are zero. So it looks as though we've got a very boring situation where space is just flat. And if this were conventional Reggie calculus, then that would certainly be the case. But in this case, we have to be a bit careful how we interpret all of this. And I'll show you by an example in a minute why you can get a non-trivial situation even though this holds. So I'm claiming this is not necessarily trivial, although it seems to be locally flat everywhere. What I'm going to do now is give an interpretation of this sort of thing in terms of particular sort of gravitational waves and discontinuous metrics. John Barrett defined something which he called refractive gravitational waves. Oh, yes, sorry.
What about the green marker?
I don't know where the green one is. Oh, there's a green one over there. Okay. I'll try that. No words. Well, I can try that. Right. So, Barrett defined the so-called refractive gravitational waves, which were a generalization of impulsive gravitational waves. So let me draw a picture. We assume we've got some null hypersurface N, and we have a metric and manifold here and another manifold and metric here. Now you can actually get solutions of Einstein's equations with this sort of setup, with at least two sorts of gravitational waves. Impulsive gravitational waves were, I think, discovered, invented by Roger Penrose. And what happens there is that even though the metric here might in general not be the same as the metric there, the metrics induced on this null hypersurface actually match. So metrics induced by G and G prime on N match. And then in the Barrett case with the refractive ones, the metrics were actually discontinuous. But areas on the null hypersurface, elements of area on the null hypersurface, they were actually they matched whether they were calculated independently of whether they were calculated with G or G prime. Now, this seems a bit like area Reggie calculus in the sense that we're having triangle areas matching. Think of this situation where we had the two force symplices meeting on a tetrahedron. The areas all matched, but the metrics, if we think of those as equivalent to the edge lengths, were discontinuous depending on which simplex we thought we were in. So I looked at this with a student of mine to see whether we could make any sense of it, and I'll tell you briefly about the calculation that we did. So again, this is the calculation with Wainwright that's referred to over there. Again, we have a triangulated manifold. Everything's triangulated. Triangulated manifold M, and we divide it up into M plus and M minus by some hypersurface sigma. And since we want zero deficit angles in area regi calculus, we take everything to be flat. So we want zero deficit angles everywhere. And we require that the areas have to be chosen to give well-defined edge lengths in M plus and M minus. The only place where things can be peculiar is on this hypersurface sigma. So if we combine that with a zero deficit angle requirement, that means that M plus and minus are both flat. And then to make things simple, we assume that this sigma is embedded into M with zero extrinsic curvature. And so the interior dihedral angles on in the simplices here will all be pi. So we did need the boundary term there. And then we'll assume that we have a lattice where every site is identical to its neighbors, except across this hypersurface. So that's the basic setup. I won't say any more about its construction, but we will now look in detail at what can happen. Let's suppose, first of all, I probably only have time to go through one of these in detail. We're going to look at the situation when this hypersurface is either time-like, space-like, or null. Let's suppose, first of all, sigma is space-like. And then remember, this is a three-dimensional hypersurface. So it's going to consist, we're taking a sort of cubic, hypercubic lattice in general, and so it'd be a cubic lattice divided into tetrahedra on the three-dimensional thing. So we're working Cartesian coordinates. And we'll assume that sigma is at t equals naught. And then on sigma, the metric's just the flat space metric. And then a typical cube is going to look like this with various diagonals drawn in. Details are not important. If this is flat, then it actually means that the edges, I'm going to be using the binary notation that I used before. So all the diagonal edges will be determined. So that's 3, 5, 6, 7 will be determined by the coordinate edges, so the basic edges in the x, y, and z directions will determine the other edges. And then what we're going to think of is we're going to think of a transformation of the edge vectors in this. We'll view this as part of one of the four manifolds, and we will apply a general linear transformation to the vectors on the edges here, keeping the areas of the triangles the same, and then the new edge lengths will be the edge lengths in the other four manifold. So we transformation of the lattice determined by 3x3 matrix T belonging to GL3 acting on x1, x2, x4, which are the vectors here, x1, x2, x4. Now I see Jurek looking very nervous, so I'm getting even more nervous.
I'm just trying to guess at which point of your lecture you are.
Well, I think I can just indicate briefly how you can show the metrics not discontinuous in this case, and then I'll just have to leave people to read the paper to see how it works in the null case, and so I can go on for about 3 more minutes and then stop. Well, it all depends on decomposing this matrix. You can actually decompose this 3x3 matrix into an orthogonal matrix, so that's in O3, and then a positive definite symmetric matrix. It's a standard result. And then you can decompose the positive definite symmetric matrix into an by changing bases, orthogonal matrix times a diagonal matrix times another orthogonal matrix. So Q's in O3 and D is... So we've just diagonalized the matrix. So T is just involving orthogonal matrices and this diagonal matrix. Well, since this was positive definite symmetric, let's say that D is it's diagonal matrix with entries ABC, where ABC all greater than 0. And then what you have to do is see how this matrix D is the only important part of it, because orthogonal matrices leave triangle areas invariant. So you have to see how this matrix D changes the areas of the triangles, because we're going to require that even though the edge lengths have changed, the areas are the same. And it turns out that in this case, the case for the space-like hypersurface, that condition is a very strong one. So D must leave areas invariant. That implies that D is proportional to the unit 3x3 unit matrix. So in fact, you can't have this non-trivial sort of ready situation where you have areas matching but the edge lengths don't match. On the other hand, when you have a null hypersurface, if you go through this same sort of process, it turns out that you can actually have a transformation which leaves the areas invariant but changes the edge lengths. And the way to interpret that is in terms of a discontinuity in the metric across here. So it's exactly like the Barrett refractive gravitational waves. Turns out, incidentally, that with the time-like case, it's the same as the space-like case. So it's only the null case where you can get this weird situation with the discontinuities in the edge lengths. So that brings up lots of questions about whether you can tile a space with null triangles, four-dimensional manifold, which you can't do. And it also means that we have to think whether it makes any sense to use area regi calculus if you can't have lots of null hypersurfaces involved in it. Well, I've run out of time, so I really must stop. So thank you very much. Well, I think the problem is that you, to really be using the area regi calculus, you do need to have all these null triangles, and I don't think anybody's been able to triangulate Schwarzschild space with null sort of with lots of null triangles. But one thing you can do is you can show that geodesics, if you consider null hypersurfaces and geodesics crossing them, the geodesics get bent. And so you can look at families of geodesics and see how they bend relative to each other and get quite strange paths of geodesics. But that's the only sort of practical application I know of this particular type of calculation. I guess so, in that the triangle inequalities have higher dimensional analogues, except they're usually expressed in terms of edge lengths. I mean, there are conditions for the volume of a tetrahedron, for V squared to be positive if you've got a real tetrahedron, which is a condition on the edge lengths. I mean, it's related to the triangle inequalities for each edge, but it's a stronger condition than just the requirement that all the triangles satisfy the triangle inequalities. So it would really depend on expressing things like the volume of a tetrahedron in terms of areas of triangles, which I think Reggie was trying to do a while ago. I don't know whether he ever succeeded in getting a nice formula. You sort of feel there ought to be a nice way of doing it, but... Perhaps I should say that it seems as though my notes are going to be scanned into the computer. I hope you can read, they're all handwritten, and the last few pages were written on the plane, so you may not be able to read those, and I apologize.